You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Hello, this is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland. It's time for Atomic Show number 68. And this morning, which is an unusual time for me to be recording, I'm going to be talking with Ray Haraldson, formerly of the Idaho National Laboratory. Ray is a rare individual. He is what I call an atomic tinkerer. Ray was one of the early employees at the National Reactor Testing Station in Idaho, near Idaho Falls. And I think that organization or that area has gone through several name changes, and now it's back to being the Idaho National Laboratory, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Yeah, I think it's been the Idaho National Laboratory, the Idaho National Engineering Laboratory, the Idaho National Engineering and Environmental Laboratory, and now it's back to its original name. But, Ray, can you tell us a little bit about your first employment or when you first started working at the National Reactor Testing Station?
Okay, well, I'm in my 80th year now, and I've been retired now in my 15th year. I had joined Argonne National Laboratory in the early days of the NRTS, and at that time there were no reactors out here, but the future was pointed in that direction. I've had 42 very pleasant years in the atomic energy field. I was a farm boy, the only Idaho native that joined Argonne National Laboratory out here as an engineer. I was the youngest of the A&L team at that time. And so I ended up working, first of all, on the EBR-1, the Experimental Breeder Reactor number 1, and the Borax Reactor, and the EBR-2, AFSR, and ZPR-3. And at the time I retired, things looked rather dismal because the reputation of the nuclear world was not very good. Felt a little bit abused, wondered what the future might be, assumed, and most of my coworkers felt like sooner or later the world would have to rediscover the good work we had done and that they would have to return to energy from a nuclear source. So I guess that kind of answers your question.
Yeah, that gives us a good background. So I think you started sometime around 1952, is that correct?
At Argonne National Laboratory on EBR-1, yes, it was January of 1952. The reactor had actually gone critical before that time. I missed it by 2 weeks because they held up my clearance, but I joined it very early.
Well, there couldn't have been much background to investigate if you grew up in Idaho.
Well, maybe so, but Q clearances did take about 4 or 5 months at that time.
Yeah, my most recent investigation actually took about 15 months, so we're not getting any better at it. Anyway, the EBR-1, Experimental Breeder Reactor 1, I believe has a couple of notable things about it. One of them is that it was the first reactor to ever produce electricity. But also, it was a very small reactor, wasn't it?
Yes. and it was as of the first breeder reactor. If you give, like, I'll give you just a little rundown on some of its peculiarities.
That'd be great.
well, it was a big step from the original CP-1. That is the Fermi pile that was first built in Chicago in the squash courts. which was fueled by Natchez uranium and graphite moderated. Here we're dealing with a reactor very different. It's fueled with uranium-235, highly enriched, about 50 kilograms. And it was cooled by a eutectic mixture of sodium potassium we called NAC, so it's NAC cooled. And an interesting thing about NAC is that it's liquid at room temperatures. The core was very small. In fact, the active part of the core, the enriched portion, was less than 9 inches high. It's about the size of a football. But the power density is rather high, about 1.4 megawatts, gives it a power density of about 1 kilowatt per cubic centimeter of volume. And it was built without the benefit of a critical assembly, except there was a couple of experiments that took place down in Los Alamos, the Clementine and Godiva critical assemblies, that give them a little hint as to what critical mass would be necessary. And so the reactor itself, which had a primary, was NAC cooled. The secondary is NAC cooled, followed by a steam generator and a 25 kilowatt turbo generator.
So it really had three separate loops. Is that so? It had a primary loop, a secondary loop, and then the steam plant.
That's right. Yes, and each component of the cooling system was blanketed with argon gas over the top of it, and expansion tanks and all that was necessary. The flow through the reactor was not a pump, but actually gravity flow from a gravity tank high up in the building. And it's in a building that's conventional. There's no real containment over it, which would be unthinkable today, but if you were to look at the building, you would not know for sure that it was a nuclear power plant.
Is that building still in existence?
Pardon?
Is that building still in existence?
Yes, in fact, it's manned by the governmental historical markers, in which they, during the summertime, it's open for tourists to make tours through it.
Oh, cool. So it's a National Historic Landmark or something like that?
Yes. But another thing that's unique about EBR-1, or because of its historical significance, its final high-risk experiment, which was assumed to be the last one before we shut it down and graduated to the EBR-2, it was a high-risk experiment which they got away from, and the reactor was substantially damaged with some meltdown. And so that's primarily how it's remembered, is the meltdown.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it melted, though, did it release any of its materials outside of the system, or did it just melt inside the system?
There was some gaseous fission products that got out, but other than that, the incident itself took place very silently, no explosion, no sound. The reactor really was, the protective system came into play, but just come into play too late.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the gaseous fission products were released, and they crept out into the building for quite a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really know whether the reactor was damaged or not. But then when the radiation alarm started sounding off, they realized that there had been at least some damage to the core itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then it followed with some political decisions that followed.
Now, as I recall, that melt of that reactor was caused by some sort of flow blockage. Is that correct?
No, I wouldn't describe it that way. The reactor, when it was first taken critical, you know, one of the first things you do is check the temperature coefficient. And on that reactor, it was showing a negative temperature coefficient of about the size you would like to have.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also observed that the reactor power, if you did anything to the flow through the reactor when you're at power,
mm-hmm.
that it behaved more like it had a positive temperature coefficient. And, of course, the answer to how we would operate with that situation was simply don't do anything with the flow while the reactor is at power. And the negative temperature coefficient was observable and was a safety benefit to us all through those years. But there was always a little bit of an unknown as to what was the reason that it showed kind of a positive coefficient when you did anything with coolant flow. Okay, well, it was just ignored and put aside because, and not dealt with until it was a last experiment that decided they were going to pursue it a little more in depth. And in that process, it wasn't that the flow was blocked. It was that they did not use any flow. They actually were treating the reactor like it was a critical assembly.
Okay.
And they were going. The plan was to go to a very low power, a matter of a few watts, and let a little bit of heat occur, but move it around a little bit to see if they could find out what this coefficient was and how it behaved. Well, that's when it got away with them on the very first try, and the reactor power suddenly climbed very rapidly. Reactor operator hit the reactor off button, which is not a full scram, but and it hesitated just for an extremely small moment, and then it took off again, and then the reactor control system, automatic system, actually scrammed the whole reactor. And then it followed this period where we looked at each other and wondered what had happened. I wasn't actually in the control room at that time. I was nearby. But little by little, they realized that there was damage, and they even sealed the building.
Interesting. Now, let me see if I understand. So the reactor, although it's only 9 inches high, still had control rods, and that was the safety system. And the damage didn't prevent the control rods from going into the core and shutting down the reactor.
That's correct. You see, on EBR-1, the control rods aren't even in the reactor tank.
Okay.
There are no moving parts other than the coolant flow in the reactor tank. The reactor tank is not all very, it's only a couple of feet in diameter, and the outer blanket, which is made up of bricks of natural uranium, with holes up through them, and the control rods went up through those holes. And now the rods are not poison rods like they are in water reactors. It was more uranium, natural uranium rods is what they were.
Okay.
So to scram this reactor, instead of drive the rods in, you drive them out.
Okay. So you're basically removing the reflector.
Yes.
Is that the, okay.
And that whole outer blanket was on a hydraulic lift. It had dropped completely away from the reactor tank.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the complete scram.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that a lot of people have difficulty understanding, is that that critical mass that you had at this center there, if it was not surrounded by something that reflected the neutrons back, wouldn't be critical. So
that's correct.
It's only critical once you bring that reflector up and get the neutrons from leaving the core completely, they'd be reflected back in, right?
It's controlled as much by leakage as anything else.
Yeah.
Neutron leakage, being fast neutrons, they leak very easily.
Yeah, but
even inside the reactor tank, there is some blanket material in there, and even above and below the active portion of the core were some natural uranium slugs, which are part of the blanket.
Right. And this whole design is called a seed and blanket design. That's how it does the breeding, right? You get surrounded by something fertile material.
Yes, fertile material.
And becomes fissile after it's absorbed some neutrons.
Yes.
Oh, good. All right, so as I told the people, as we said in the beginning, I consider that you and your teammates were certainly maybe the only people in the U.S. who ever had the opportunity to really kind of tinker with different ideas and concepts, and after some work with the breeder that experimental breeder reactor one, you moved to the first boiling water reactor known as Borax 1. What was the genesis? Why did we decide that we wanted to start boiling water? I'm a pressurized water guy, and we always kind of avoided boiling.
Okay. And before we're through with EBR-1, I want to mention how we found out really what was going on.
Okay. Go ahead.
It turns out that the temperature coefficient, which was negative and comfortable, was made up of more than one component, primarily two components. And these had to do with the expansion of the rods within the fuel inside the reactor itself. And the one component, which was caused by the fact that the temperature at the center of the reactor is higher than the edge, causes the rods to move together and increases reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
And the negative part was caused by large support plates that were just above and below the reactor. It's a plate about 2 inches thick and has holes through it, which the fuel elements were pushed down through. Okay, it has a temperature gradient across it, too, and that effect is negative. But the fact that it's big and heavy, it has a very slow time constant. And so we, in effect, had a temperature coefficient, which was overall was negative, but was really made up of two primary components, one that was fast and positive, one that was slow and negative. And when they tried to reuse that reactor as a critical assembly at low or almost zero power, it was the positive one that took over.
Mm-hmm.
And that was proven because we were not allowed to shut the reactor down. We had to rebuild it to find the answer. And yes, in those days we were pretty free to do what we wanted, not quite entirely, because one thing, they would not let us shut that reactor down and walk away from it without knowing what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it was that occurred actually after the Borix experiments. If based on your question, I guess I moved to the story about Borix.
Oh, you can do that unless there actually is another interesting thing to talk about with the EBR, now that you brought it up, and that is that one thing that may be a little confusing to a lot of people is sometimes the most dangerous time in operating a reactor is if you're operating with very low power levels. I mean, extremely low, what we used to call below the measurable level or the fiducial level, because things can happen with reactivity that you don't know are happening, and you can cause very rapid power changes. And
yes, the monitors had to monitor through about 6 decades of power level from
mm-hmm.
extremely low, and the first thermal level shows up after you're about 5 decades up from the source level.
Right.
And yes, and that, you could be blind in that period, but I think we were pretty well covered.
Yeah, but if you read the Chernobyl reports very deeply, you'll find that most of their problems also occurred because the reactor was pretty stable at normal operating power levels, but when it was at very low power levels with a certain kind of power history, that's when it became very unstable.
And Chernobyl had a positive temperature coefficient right from day one.
Well, actually, it was only positive under certain conditions. It was negative temperature coefficient for most of its operating condition. It was only positive under very certain conditions with a high power history and very low power. And the reason is because their temperature coefficient consisted of more than one component, just like it, what you were describing. And the water itself was normally a poison in that reactor because it was moderated by graphite. But if the water got too hot and expanded away and started boiling, it disappeared. And so that is what added the positive reactivity. But anyway.
Well, also the fact that Chernobyl was graphite moderated, large volume of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that they knew the graphite, which over a period of time it takes on radiation damage, which is absorbing the energy.
Right.
Which, if you ever raise it to above a certain temperature, it starts giving it back off and heats itself up and contributed to the fire that followed.
Yes, that's the Wigner energy or something. Yeah. I think that's what it's called. And it's
form of radiation damage to the graphite.
Right. That was the cause of the wind scale accident in Great Britain in the 50s was that same kind of graphite heating. All right, so I think we're going to go back over to this boiling water experiment. Said, up until the time when you guys started working on Borax, most folks involved in reactor design thought that we needed to keep, if you're going to use water, you need to keep it under high pressure so that it would not boil, because they were afraid of what would happen if the water started boiling. inside the reactor core itself, but you guys found something different.
Yes, and Borax had its origin from a unique event that took place in Chicago. It was the critical assembly where there was a small accident. It was the critical assembly for the Nautilus reactor. And it was, of course, well after the Nautilus work was well underway, but they were still in operation to test various compounds. And this particular event took place as they were measuring the reactivity values of different control rod designs. And it would become so routine that they got careless, and after having made one run in the critical assembly, they walked into the cell and took a hold of the very rod they had just measured and yanked it out by hand without having dropped the water from around the core itself. Now, the core is a mock-up of the real reactor, but it's really just a lucite plastic version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the accident itself caused the reactor itself to have a minimum explosion, but it threw the water out of the reactor, doused the guys who went down there to pick it up. There's four of them.
Mm-hmm.
And radiated them quite extensively. They were radiated at a level which was below the lethal level, but substantially above where biological effects take place. I think almost all of them lost their hair.
Mm-hmm.
But after the event, they sat back and thought about it and said, well, what was it that shut the reactor down? It had to do with boiling. Maybe boiling is a safety factor rather than a nervous contributor of unknown future. Well, that occurred in June 2nd of 1952, and it allowed them to think about it. And by the spring of 1953, they decided they were going to do an experiment out here in Idaho, which they'd find out once and for all whether or not boiling was a stabilizing fact in a water reactor, and to learn just what it would be like if you were pushed a water reactor to its limits. And so that was the situation when the Borax experiment, Borax stood for Boiling Water Reactor Experiment,
mm-hmm.
and it was designed in Chicago. In fact, I believe the control rods was really from that critical assembly. Was brought out here to Idaho and arrived here in the spring of 1953 and then put into operation rather quickly. But the actual reactor itself didn't even have a building over it. It was, they dug a hole in the ground, put a fuel tank down half submerged in the ground, mounded the dirt around it, and put a reactor tank in the middle of that, and then put the reactor inside that, and shortly thereafter with a control rod, a control room itself was just a trailer on mm-hmm. the end of electrical cables a half mile away from it,
okay.
because it was known they were going to be pushing the thing to some pretty severe tests.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reactor was taken critical in a standard way. It had a negative temperature coefficient. And the approach to critical was fairly normal, and then they found they could go to power and actually generate a boiling situation. And instead of being unstable, it was really quite stable. And then they started wondering, well, what if you push it a little harder, what happens? And then they pushed it still harder. They came into a realm where they could now, they really called it chugging. That is, it's a kind of a stable, unstable situation where the water is being thrown up away from the core and that falls back down, and these chugs were pretty impressive. They were about a second apart from each other, a little more than a second.
Mm-hmm.
And during the chugs, the reactor power, which we were able to measure, went way up. In fact, that was like, you could go up to like 100 megawatts.
Okay.
Just for an instant, and then drop back down to normal conditions. But for stable operation, we were able to operate at a few megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the situation which made it very teasing. And I wondered, well, could this really be the a form of a viable power reactor? And that's what gave birth to, well, ultimately, the GE boiling water reactor design. And but they still weren't content to just simply test it in this, to this level. They want to know what really happened, would happen if you pressed it all the way as far as you could, as much as you could. What would the accident really be like? And that's what led us to, actually, in this case, a purposeful test all the way to destruction of the first Borix. Well, it was called Borix 2 by then.
Okay. Well, let me interrupt you for a second. Just to make it a little bit more clear, the Borax reactor was inside of a tank of water, kind of like the swimming pool reactors you might see at a college. Is that?
Yes, the shield tank could have water in it or might not. That it surrounded the reactor tank. The reactor tank itself was supposed to be capable of being put under pressure, but it was never very satisfactory. It was made flange sections, and it was supposed to be able to go up to 300 pounds, but we were never able to do that. And
so you all operated with it with the top open, though, right?
Yes, the top was open. And the shield tank may or may not have water in it. The actual reactor tank itself was more like a conventional water reactor. It was filled with water, and but there was no circulation in those early days.
Right. Okay, so the shield tank is just surrounding this the reactor tank.
Yes, and those tests that were impressive with water jets shooting up out of the ground attracted quite a bit of attention around about. Tourists traveling on Highway 20 would see this jet of water coming out and wonder what it's all about.
It's a new Old Faithful, huh?
Yes. Well, then when fall came, they, of course, we couldn't continue in the winter here in Idaho under the wintertime conditions. But it allowed us to think a great deal, and they decided how they would push the thing to total destruction. We were able to predict a little bit about when fuel melting would start to occur. So it was the next year that...
So we're now to 1954, is that right?
Yes, 1954 is when the with modified control rod drives, because we made some control rod itself, the center control rod, was going to be ejected very as quick as possible with a very strong spring on it. It was 2.6% delta K over K reactivity. That's way above which would drive you into the prompt critical region. But we'd already been in what would be the prompt critical region that, with other tests, and found that the boiling compensated and maintain the reactor stable even when you're dealing with those larger reactivity changes. So the actual test of destruction, which was in 1954, with this very, very strong central rod, was deliberately ejected, and at the highest speed they could make it do with a 900-pound spring force on it. And that's what produced the destructive test of the Borax.
So who designed the mechanism to get that rod out of the core?
Yes. So that's the reason we had to rebuild the control rod. And then it's called Borax 2, even though the core was still the same core, but the control rods had been changed.
No, I said, who designed that mechanism to get that central rod out of the core fast?
I was involved with that myself. I designed the magnet and the spring system, which fired that thing out. But there was our whole team was only a dozen people total, and we did we were free to do such things in those days.
Who was the leader of that team?
Well, of course, the laboratory director, which was Walter Zinn. He normally has had his office in Chicago, but any time anything was interesting, he was out in Idaho, and he, of course, then we could say he was in charge. But directly below him was Harold Lichtenberger. Harold was my boss, and he was a reactor engineer, a brilliant guy who really knew the system very, very well, and he was in charge of things that were going on of that type, except when Zinn was directing things above him.
Mm-hmm. What was it like working for Dr. Zinn? I've heard that he and Admiral Rickover used to clash a bit.
I don't think they had a strong admiration for each other, but still, from where I sit, both of them are brilliant. I saw both of them in action. I was around them a little bit. I was around Zinn continuously. I still have high admiration for Zinn, but they both had personality characteristics which were occasionally amusing and not what you'd expect.
Yes. Now, as I remember, Dr. Zinn was on the list of people that was at CP1 back on December 2nd, 1942.
Yes, he was. He worked directly with Fermi. But some of our other DR, EBR-1 people were also there. But Zinn worked directly under Fermi.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a lot said about him. I never saw Fermi in person, but see, after the CP1 and the preliminary, those early tests were made.
Mm-hmm.
And the Oppenheimer group went out to Los Alamos to perfect the bomb. Fermi stayed in Chicago, and they were busy making the measurements,
mm-hmm.
Which ultimately resulted in what they call the Barn Book, giving the cross sections for the characteristics of materials under radiation.
Yeah, that's an interesting unit of measure. You know, how many neutrons hit on the side of a barn, I think, is how people described it.
Yes, they were talking about the word barn came from what they call a cross-sectional target equivalent area of some target
mm-hmm.
molecule. And when they were giving it actually a physical dimension, someone something, and that's as big as a barn. Well, it's really a microscopic barn at best.
Right.
But that's how the word the barn book came into being, and it was essentially complete when General Groves requested that Fermi go out to Los Alamos. But I don't think Fermi had a real close relationship with Oppenheimer either.
Right.
In fact, he arranged for his office to be at the far end of the site, and I don't think he participated in the bomb development out there, but this also corresponds to the time that he became fatally ill from a cancer.
Mm. Going back to the Borax test to destruction, you had a central rod that was going to be ejected rapidly. And
yes.
You guys probably tested that a couple of times or just once.
Well, we could treat it as part of the accident, or we were able to run the reactor without firing it out, and we did.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the morning of the test, we wanted to check everything as all was working again, and we actually took the reactor into boiling mode. And we're able to detect that the fuel elements, which occasionally after they had transient tests, the outer plate of the MTR-type fuel element would reverse its... it was concave, it would become convex, mm-hmm. and drag on the control rod. And we observed that we had some dragging occurring, and I was one of the guys who... very early in the morning before daylight, was sent down there to correct that problem, and we had a novel way of correcting damage to those fuel elements that were had the outer plate bowed the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
Actually had to lift the fuel element up out of the reactor. We did this by hand in open air and observed that that's what the problem was, that the outer plate, you could see it, it was...
Mm-hmm.
And we'd lay it down on the deck and take a 2x4 and just line it up exactly right and come down kawham on top of that last fuel plate and pop it back into place and put it back in the reactor. But normally we'd do this the day after a test so that the the decay heat had dropped off quite a bit, but this morning we had to do it while the reactor had just been in operation, so I had a very high radiation dose while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But was to get it ready because we had visitors and everyone else coming there to see this destructive test. And
back then, at that time, what when you say you had a high radiation dose, can you remember what the number was for that?
Well, in combination with what happened after the test, my total radiation for the day's activity was 15 R. Now, at that time, we were allowed, I think, 300 MR per week. And, of course, we knew we were way over it.
Mm-hmm.
But this was not ordinary circumstance. It was a special test. We were under those kind of pressures. So not only myself, but many others had high radiation level doses, but I got part of mine before the test occurred.
Yeah, pulling out a fuel plate after you just re-operated the reactor has to be giving you just a little bit of a dose there.
Yes, you look down in the reactor before you pull the fuel element out into the under the water, you can see the Cherenkov glow.
Mm-hmm.
As you pull that same glowing fuel element out on the deck, of course it's not glowing when it gets out into air, but it makes you think a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we were concerned, but we thought we knew what we were doing.
Okay, so the fix on that is a whack with a 2x4.
Right.
That's a, been the fix for some of the
world.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the fix I've used for some of the people I've worked for over the years. Just whack them with a 2x4; they'll remember what they're supposed to do.
Yes, and then we put it back together, and the test went off, and it was much more severe than I think it was anticipated. It destroyed the reactor dramatically. It scattered fuel, which had been partly molten, around about a couple of acres.
Mm-hmm.
And the fuel tank, or the reactor tank, was split into pieces and scattered. And it was fairly dramatic. It was they later were able to establish the energy level as 135 megawatt seconds.
Wow.
The energy of the blast. And it's interesting that that corresponds almost identically to what they learned about the SL1 accident, 135 megawatt seconds.
Well, it's interesting. The SL1 accident had very similar characteristics in that it was a central control rod that was yanked out of the core by hand.
Right.
But it once it started moving, it got ejected out of the core very quickly.
Yes.
And that was also a boiling water reactor, as I remember.
Now, at the very moment that we're doing this test, the next Borix reactor, the new reactor tank, had arrived on site, and it was presumed that we would just immediately go to work on the next version of Borix, which we did do. However, we had to abandon that immediate site. We actually just rotated the cables on a radius from the control room about 15 degrees and started over again, and this time we put a building over it and, and a little
now,
led to a power plant.
Now, after you did the destructive test, you all spent some time going around and picking up all the pieces. What was the hurry? It seems like it would have been better just to leave those pieces lying and go pick them up after they had a chance to decay.
Okay, well, the Borix experiment itself included having gold foils in a number of locations inside the reactor. This was the method at that time to be able to find out what the total integrated reactor energy had been. You know, the gold activates from the neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
And you take those, after a test, you take those foils. They're about 1 square centimeter each direction and very thin. And after a test, you take these things out and put them in some kind of counters and do some mathematics, and you're able to tell what the power distribution is and what the total power, integrated power was. Well, there were about 60, I'm not sure how many, foils that were in that reactor. But you've got to get them out in time to put them in the counter before they decay to too low a level to be able to do any real analysis of really what all happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was our job to go down there and look particularly carefully among the debris and even back in the reactor shield tank to see if we could find those foils. And we found enough of them that they are able to, and that's where this 135 megawatt tankage comes from, is from the benefit of being able to find enough boils, and they had numbers on them to tell you where they were in the core.
Wow. And so all these foils probably had some sort of indication of where they came from within the reactor, some sort of marking on
that? Yes, they had a number on them. I mean, it was embossed number, and they knew where they had been, so they were able to give a pretty good profile. They were able, among other things, to identify that that center control rod was not all the way out when the test was essentially all over. The rapid explosion is fast enough. I mean, we're in the prompt critical region now.
Mm-hmm.
It's asking a lot for water boiling to take place quick enough to suppress such high reactivity values.
Right. Okay, so I guess you guys kind of cleaned up that area a little bit, and maybe what'd you do with all the debris?
Okay, well, the reactor tank itself, on one side of it, was connected to what we call the pump pit. It actually had a kind of a roof over it, but inside it were some preheaters and the feed water pump and a few other typical things that you'd find in a water reactor. The explosion had blown out that direction into that pump pit, and little by little we were able to pick up fuel pieces that were scattered around the area with tongs, and they tended to look like little pieces of clinker. And finally, we even get into the reactor tank, that shield tank itself. In fact, I was one of them who worked in that shield tank. And as you get the radiation levels down lower and lower, you're able to investigate even deeper. And so I found myself standing in with boots on and in about 2 feet of water in the bottom of that shield tank, sifting through the muck in the bottom of the tank for foils. Well, these pieces of fuel nut were tended to be just thrown into that old pump pit. It became the burial place for a lot of the debris that came from off the site from around the area. And eventually the area was, I think it's still marked to this day, but after they picked up everything they could, they dumped a lot of sand on it and roped it off, and I think it might well be that way today.
Okay. All right, so let's go on and briefly discuss the Borax 3. I know it was used for several experiments, but at the end of the, or one of the most things it's most famous for is that it was the source of electricity for the lighting of the first, quote, city ever powered by nuclear electricity.
That's correct. Yes, with the arrival of that new reactor tank, now it was rated for 600 pounds, and we're able to put a lid on it and actually start checking boiling water reactors under pressure. And furthermore, they observed that they could improve upon the power in the reactor by putting chimneys allowing some natural convection to take place on the top of the fuel elements. The fuel elements were actually MTR fuel elements, just borrowed from them. They were machined a little bit different to make them fit our situation. And so with the Borax 3, the one that lit ARCO, it's a little different reactor, still MTR fuel elements, but modified.
Mm-hmm.
And the control rods that were took a trip to the into the sky after the destructive test were recovered, mm-hmm. reworked, and put back to work on the Borax 3. And we spent quite a bit of the summer there taking very pieces of equipment, washing them in high detergents and making sure they were clean, and then checking them out and refurbishing them, and they became part of the EBR-3.
Okay.
And then with EBR-3, we begin to taken the reactor to power, found that they could, well, I think we're getting about 6 megawatts of steam out of an open air. That is a discharge pipe that just was to the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was doing very, very well. We didn't do any more transient tests on that reactor, but we were looking at the idea of converting it to a power plant.
Mm-hmm. So you had to have some way to capture that steam and keep it at high enough pressure to turn a turbine.
Yes. There were some political things happened then. We were in competition with the Russians was on.
Mm-hmm.
And shall I go into that part of it?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Okay. Well, up to about that point, the U.S., which had the atomic bomb and was smug in their superior role of being the leader in the atomic energy field. But in the meantime, the Russians were successful in their bomb test, and the competition became much more keen.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, there was a international meeting on atomic energy. It took place in Geneva, Switzerland. And the everyone except the Russians and the Americans would present papers talking about their progress in using atomic energy and for useful purposes other than war. But the Americans, while they would attend, they would not participate because they felt that their world was still appropriately secret.
Right.
Didn't want to share it with the Russians.
Well, and also I think at that time we were still under the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, what was known as the McMahon Act, and that had very strict rules about what could be shared.
Well,
so
I
it was,
don't remember anything about that part of it, but it figures.
Yeah.
And the Russians
because,
were behaving the same way.
Yeah, because the Atomic Energy Act didn't change until after Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech in December of 1953. Soon after that, the Congress decided they would relax some restrictions.
So it was in the latter part of 54 when they started working in this direction, and the Russians suddenly announced that they were going to present a paper at the 1955 Geneva Convention where they're going to make a presentation on their 5-megawatt civilian power-producing nuclear reactor.
Mm-hmm.
This was going to make it look rather bad for the U.S. and the fact that we had no counterpart. Well, of course, we did, but we didn't know whether we wanted to reveal it.
Right.
And it was then that after looking around about as well, what could we present as a paper that might upstage them? While the shipping port reactor was arriving on scene and was going to produce power, but it was based on the submarine reactor, which had, I guess you'd say, a tainted heritage, being a submarine reactor. Boris
not strictly a civilian commercial use reactor.
Yeah. Well, Boris had no stigma of that type, and it was concluded, well, all we need to do is hook a power plant onto this thing, and we can produce power. And the announcement with the Russians was in the fall of 1954, and the conference they were going to present the paper was the following July of 1955. There was enough time in there if we really worked fast to hook a steam power plant onto that Borax 3 reactor and actually do something spectacular for the world. And so that's how it started. And but it was time-wise a difficult thing to do because the steam coming out of that reactor was wet steam and there weren't any turbines which were designed for wet steam at the time. I mean, they might have been if you went back into history far enough back that the first turbines were running on wet steam, but there was nothing commercially available of that type. But it was Morrison Knudsen contractor, Cost Plus, which was rescued the moment, and found a old 1925-built Westinghouse turbo generator at a mill pond down in near Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Okay.
So it eventually allowed Westinghouse to claim they're building atomic turbines in 1925.
they could predict it.
That thing was shipped up to Idaho, and Morris Knudsen even built the building, and they had some very good power plant people, and refurbished the turbo generator and both electrical and steam power plant end of it. And that's what allowed us to arrive at the point where we could actually consider lighting the town of Arco.
Mm-hmm.
And lighting Arco only was part of the picture to show that not only could we produce power, but producing power for an honest-to-goodness American town.
Right, because we'd already produced electricity with EBR, I mean the EBR-1 by that time.
That's correct.
It was a matter of doing something that proved we could actually light up a town with the, you know, producing enough power. I guess EBR-1 was fairly limited as far as how much power it could produce.
Yes, we had a 25-kilowatt turbo generator on it, which most of it would be used right there in our own plant. We could send a little power to central facilities, but we could not get enough power past them to be as significant. So there was no ever attempt to do anything more than what we did.
Mm-hmm.
But
how big was the turbine that you found for Borax 3?
It was 3.75 megawatts officially. It was designed for a little bit of superheat, but it would run on wet steam.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the Borax did not have the baffles that modern boiling water reactor plants have on it, so the steam was wetter than a boiling water plant would have to face today.
Mm-hmm.
It was a three bearing turbine. It was kind of an odd thing because they're hard to balance.
Mm-hmm.
But the Morris and Knudsen people were good at it, and they did a very good job of balancing that turbine and getting it refurbished, ready for our use.
Mm-hmm. So let's see, what kind of challenges did you face in hooking this turbo generator up and getting it, the power all the way to Arco?
Well, we've arrived at the point where there's a lot of things happened. Makes a story all by itself, and a substantial one at that.
Yeah, maybe
what
we'll
all went wrong and what went right, getting that power to Arco.
You know, maybe it would be good at this point, because we've gone almost an hour here, if we go ahead and leave that story for our next session.
There's enough there.
Yeah, I would like to talk to you again. I think that this is fascinating stuff, especially since, you know, this is, most people today grow up in an era where, you know, you didn't think about experimenting and playing around with nuclear energy because, geez, you might, you know, lose your hair. By the way, what happened to those folks that lost their hair when on the critical assembly when they got splashed with the water?
Well, you know, among my coworkers, I've paid some attention to see, since I was one of the younger ones, most of them are deceased, how many of them died of cancer. And at the moment, I can't find any of my direct, close related coworkers who died of cancer from what might be a result of radiation exposure. Of course, the data sample is pretty small, but when I hear about people who are insisting that their problems are related to having been way downstream from certain nuclear tests, I'm a bit skeptical.
Mm-hmm. So do you know what your lifetime exposure level was? I mean, your one day was better, more than I ever got in 5 years of submarine duty, but...
No, I do not know what it is, but following the destructive test at Borax, we all were running against our normal legal limit of 300 MR per week in the cleanup that was taking place down there. So for many, many weeks, we were running right against it constantly. And I... it was a hot summer days that we were dealing with, and I found it convenient to volunteer for fairly high radiation levels because of, I was all dressed up and with masks and everything else for dealing in that area, and it was uncomfortable. So mm-hmm. I could minimize my time by volunteer for the high radiation jobs.
Yeah, I know that part of the reason we have some of the limits we do is that there were people who would, if there was any reward for getting extra doses, they would volunteer for those duties or that kind of stuff. So that's one of the reasons why many of the limits and as low as reasonably achievable rules were put into place to prevent an atmosphere where people would say, well, geez, if I could get paid for more radiation doses, I'll take it.
We didn't get paid for ours, but we did it.
Yeah. Well, Ray, I think it's been a lot of fun this morning, and I think that I would, again, like to schedule another time with you to talk about the lighting of ARCO and maybe some of your other later experiences, because people like you need to tell your stories, because it's... I think we're getting ready for a new nuclear age, hopefully with some stories like yours and the knowledge that we've learned over the last 50 years, we'll maybe have a little bit more success this time, although we've had some pretty reasonable success for the first 50 years.
It looks much more encouraging now than it has for a long time, and I do indeed believe that we made a real contribution, that atomic energy is... well, it has some problems. They are much. It has much more promise than any alternative that I can think of. So I hope that it's recognized as such, and something good comes of it all.
All right. You have a good weekend.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye. Okay.
Are you looking for a podcast that's on the cutting edge of what's new and exciting on the internet? A podcast for users about the things that matter to them. The Global Geek Podcast is this and more. A podcast about the latest technology news, reviews and interviews, applications and programs to make life easier, sites and services that are useful, fun, productive or just plain interesting. Not forgetting the Get Chicken segment. Presented by two hosts on opposite sides of the globe. We really are the Global Geek Podcast. Find us at www.globalgeekpodcast.com on the podcast network. Two hemispheres, two geeks, one podcast.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.